Silly Conversations, the podcast. Your host, Denzel Mills.
Hey, 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 this is Silly Conversations. And today I have somebody very special. Now, every week I say I have somebody special. Well, not every week, every 2 weeks I say I have somebody special. But I think this person is going to be very interesting for you to find out a little bit about what she does. And I've got one special question to ask her. And depending on the answer, it will come out in the podcast or not. So I'm going to leave my guest today to introduce herself, and then we'll take it from there. Podcasting world, podcasting people. Sit down, relax, have some chocolate, have some wine ready, and listen to Virginia. Virginia, welcome. I bet you've never had an introduction like that before.
I never had. Hi, Denzel. How are you doing?
Well, I'm fine doing what I like to do, which is the whole new podcast thing which has started, which is kind of like an extension of my classes. And these podcasts, I think, are interesting because, like I said, I've met a load of interesting people, and you are probably one of the most interesting ever. So tell us, tell me, tell everybody who you are. What do you do?
My name is Virginia Soldino, and I work as a university professor in Valencia, and I teach criminology, but I'm a forensic psychologist who got a PhD in criminology, so both science mixed together, which they are very known for the movies, but I think it's not quite accurate with what we actually do.
Tell people exactly what does a criminologist do? And then also, because you said you're a psychologist, criminologist as well?
Oh, you can say criminal psychologist.
Okay, yeah. So give us both sides. First of all, a criminologist, and then from your perspective, the other side, I'm going to get this right. Criminologist, psychologist.
Forensic psychologist.
Right. Now I'm learning. Forensic psychologist. And I won't cut this out. I'll keep it in. Forensic psychologist. So give us both parts, or explain to people both parts.
Okay. Well, there are debates still on what really is criminology. But the main difference, and this is very key to understand the difference, is that criminology is not criminalistics. So if we think about true crime, if we think about CSI, crime scene investigation, that would be criminalistics. So it's investigating how a crime was committed, no? The crime scene investigation.
Right.
Criminology is the social science that is dedicated to the study of crime, of criminals, of victims, but also on it's focused on how society is with crime. So it will be more social science centered on the observation, analysis, research on criminal behavior and crime in general.
What kind of brought you to this kind of study? What was the thing that kind of said, oh, this is the route I would like to take?
Probably like most of our students, I was fascinated by horror movies, you know, police investigation. I also wanted to be a police investigator. I wanted to be an FBI special agent, just like Clarissa Starling.
So
that was my dream. I wanted to live in, well, actually in Virginia, no, where the headquarters of the FBI are, in Quantico. That was my dream. And then I did some research about how to become a special agent on the FBI. And I saw first I had to be an American citizen. So
that was like one thing which made it a little bit difficult. Yes.
Yeah. So it was like, okay, I don't have this right. So I don't know. Maybe if I move to the States. But then I saw a physical test, many hours of training physically. A lot of questions. I didn't have such a good English at that time. So I thought, okay, probably they won't get me there. They won't have me as a choice. So So I said, okay, well, let's be a police officer in Spain, because at least I'm Spanish. So that's right. One of the requirements I have. But then I realized I was too short to be a police officer in Spain.
You see, it's amazing you're not working in a shop.
Yeah. So I said, okay, so my dream is, this is impossible. What can I do? And then I had a professor who was a forensic psychologist. I asked him about it, about his job. And connected to your previous question, forensic psychology will be all the psychology that will be developed in a forensic setting, which is in any kind of setting related to judicial court, prisons, police, law enforcement. So any kind of activity in psychology that is related to the criminal procedure.
Right. So then that last part, which you explained, so would this be for when there is maybe a court case or something, and they want to get maybe, I'm going to use terminology, which maybe is not the correct terminology, but I'm just using it, and they want to understand the profile, the mental health of this person or the motives of this person, would it be somebody like you who would do some kind of investigation or study or test on a person like that?
Exactly. So if the judge has doubts on the psychological condition of the... I don't remember.
You don't know. We can call it El Cabron or the person who committed a crime, whichever one you want to choose.
Yeah, okay. The one who allegedly committed a crime, the defendant here, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so if the judge has doubts on the psychological circumstances which were active in the moment of the crime, then the forensic psychologist will be the person who will do a report explaining to the judge, okay, this person at the moment he or she committed a crime was having a psychotic break, for instance. So at that time, that person couldn't know what was happening, couldn't understand that their actions were not the best or that they were wrongful. So that would be a rule, for instance, one of the rules.
But then in terms of this interview, questioning or investigation from somebody like you, obviously it needs to be deep. I've never been to a psychologist, etc. So I don't know the whole process, but I mean, how deep, I'm going to use the word deep, how deep are you going to go into the psyche of this person? Are we going to go back and draw those, I don't know what they call it when they draw those maps of the family and the connections and things like this? Or is it, I'm just talking rubbish, which is quite possibly true.
It depends on what is your role in that particular case. So if your role is to determine if that person was able to understand their actions, if their actions were wrongful, then you just have to determine that if in the moment of the crime, that person was able to understand and to act according to their understanding. But in other cases, maybe a forensic psychologist can also work in a civil case, for instance, when there is a divorce and you have to determine who will take charge of the children. That's also one of our roles. So it's not only in criminal proceedings, it's also in civil cases. I didn't realize. Yeah, so as I said, everything related to the courts, that doesn't mean that it has to be only for murder or only for, sexual offense. It can be any kind of case.
So if I had a really difficult student and I had a problem, I could ask you for some help, couldn't I? To kind of just check out. I've had some difficult students, but I could ask you for some help to check out, really, should I really stick with this person or is it better to say goodbye?
If it goes to the point that you have to go to a court, then probably yes.
Well, I'll try and do preventative things. I'm into preventative medicine as well and preventative activities. So if I could probably get an heads up before, it'll be a lot easier before we need to go to that port. With working at the uni, do you get involved in some cases? Because obviously you've got your university work. With the work you do, I see you on LinkedIn and you're doing lots of publications as well and collaborative works and things like that. So do you actually get an opportunity and do some of this work related to the courts. I know you specialize in a particular area, but is it something that at this moment you don't have enough time to participate in because you're involved in many other things?
Right now, I'm a full-time university professor, which means my activities are related to university professors. We have to teach, but we also have to do research, which means that many people think that when it's summer, we're all on vacation, but that's not true. So we also do research where we are not in the classroom. And that means a lot of work. Actually, most of my time is dedicated to scientific research. And in our case, even if we are criminologists, our research is not about the criminal investigation itself, because that's the role of the police officers, of law enforcement officers. In our case, what we do is we respond to questions, scientific questions. So, for instance, if our society is worried, the case of Spain, for instance, we are worried about the prevention of intimate partner violence, no, or gender violence, scientific researcher in criminology will be dedicated to understand what kind of actions we can develop in terms of reducing the amount of intimate partner violence incidents, for instance. So our research is not about the current case that is happening, that is seen on all the media. It's more about waiting for having a, if we do quantitative analysis, when we have a big enough sample, which is, okay, so for already 100 cases have happened. So now is when I go deep into those cases and try to find variables that I can analyze. So what was happening in all these cases? What do they have in common? And what kind of variables could I predict in the future in terms of reducing the possibility of this to happen? So
but obviously with this research and investigation, and then this information is then published in journals, etc. But I suppose also for the authorities at different levels. But my question is, when you started to go on that, and I don't want to go too much down a political route, do people listen? Do you really think people listen?
Well, it's very difficult because, and that happens every day with our students. In my case, I teach to freshmen, so first-year students. And they have been so used to hear, they don't watch the news anymore. So they are so used to hear what they see on TikTok, what they see on Instagram. So very short videos have very simple messages that are not very accurate. So they have been listening to that, watching that all day. And then there is one professor in the university that tells them, no, this is actually not accurate. Right. This is not scientifically correct. And they say, oh, okay, they take notes. But the next day, they will see the same video. Then they will see another politician saying another thing. And then what I said in class, it was just one note on their notebook.
Yeah. But is that frustrating? Yeah. Is that frustrating, though, dealing with people who, and it's natural, you know, generations are going to change, people get influenced in different ways, and it's easier to think as a group rather than as an individual. But is it frustrating to say that you're actually trying to, people choose to do this course or choose to do these particular subject areas, don't seem to want to dig a little bit deeper? Even if it's out of personal interest, you know, they'll do the papers, they'll attend class, they'll take notes. But do you get the sensation that it's not entering, you know, it's not getting in their head, basically?
Yes. I always tell them that scientific research is not about opinions. I can have one opinion about the criminal justice system, but if my role is to be a scientific researcher, I have to do science. I have to apply the scientific method. So you can have your own religion, your own political thoughts, but when it comes to science, you have to be very accurate. You have to apply the scientific method. And many times, well, this takes longer than to say an opinion in a bar. I can say, okay, so I don't know, death penalty to everybody. And that's what I think. Okay, but if you do the research and then you find contradictory results, you have to be ethical with your work and you have to say what your results were. So maybe these results, the government doesn't like them. But yeah, your role as a scientist is to,
yeah,
to
but
say
I think
what you got.
I think this idea of ethics and morals, to be quite honest, is just disappearing. You know, I just think as time goes by and certain things have happened, I just think the whole idea of certain level of ethics and morals, and I'm no kind of moral kind of person who decides that everybody should do things right this way or the other. But some basic things, you know, the day-to-day things when we're walking around the street, the day-to-day things, relationships with friends and people, that kind of standing that people in certain public places probably in the past would have acted differently. Now it's quite easy to say, oh, I said this, I'll retract it on Twitter or whatever it was on the news and everything's fine. And people live by that and people kind of just follow that mantra now. So how many students per term or per year are you actually going through this study? Because like I said, it's a very niche area of study, I think.
So criminology is very popular,
yeah,
because it attracts the attention of the people because they think there will be criminal investigators, there will be the true crime series. True crime series are very popular. Most of the people are consumers of true crime. And they think criminology will be going to class to hear about serial killers all day and become the new detective that will appear on an Netflix movie.
So remember what you told me at the very beginning. You wanted to be in the FBI, not American. You didn't fancy the whole idea of the exercises and tests that you needed to do. Wanted to be in the police in Spain? Too short. So when people come into the class, do you present that to them and say, well, first of all, if you think you're going to be chasing serial killers, leave. If you think you're going to be this, leave. You know, do you go through a list of things like saying, this is what it's not? And then people leave.
Do.
Yeah.
That was the last year, one of our goals with my colleague Veronica and I. We tried we did a complementary, we call it innovation, teaching innovation actions.
And right.
This particularly was about trying to make them understand what really is criminology.
Yeah, so
and
to
what
dispel these ideas that maybe people have,
Yeah, exactly. And I remember one particular student, my colleague told me, this particular student didn't do the last exam. And we were wondering what is going on, what happened. And then my colleague found this student on the train and asked, well, what happened? Why did you leave the course? And that person said, well, because you told me and you made me realize that what I wanted to do was not criminology. I wanted to do social work. That was my true, that's what I wanted
vocation
to do.
Vocation is true vocation,
I just got it wrong and I thought it was criminology because of what I have seen on the movies or on the series. And my colleague was, that's fantastic. That's exactly what we want to.
But that's the thing, I think. So I think it's quite cool for that guy to then say, you know, I actually realized that wasn't what I wanted to do, but I know the direction. So do you have a high dropout rate generally or in comparison? What high is, I'm not too sure, but do you comparatively think, you have a high dropout rate?
We do. So when we have a double, it's called the double degree in law and criminology, and then we have the regular degree in criminology. The degree in criminology has very high dropout rates on the first year in comparison to the double degree and also in comparison to other degrees in the university. And we think that first it might be that they realize that that's not what they thought it was. It could also be because they start not having such good grades as they expected to have.
Right.
Maybe they switch to another one. Or there are others who want to switch to a degree which has more opportunities in the job market. Because, well, the job market in general in Spain, we know, is not the best, and it's quite challenging. Yeah. Then if you don't make the right choices, it will be harder. So in this particular case, the job market is not very aligned to what we offer at the
You're going to need to do some spectacular promotion. You need to think of something to attract people. You need to think of something. Listen, one day we can sit down, and obviously by the time your podcast comes out, you'd have listened to quite a few others. You will know how my mind works. And we can do something to attract even more people and get them staying even better. This is my question, right? Could you look at me? I've been dying to ask this question. And you know, I have to admit, I've been thinking, should I ask the question? Should I not ask the question? But do I have psychopathic tendencies? Do you look at me and think, oh, Denzel, you know, he's an English teacher, but I'm sure deep down inside there's some tendencies there to kind of just kill somebody? At first sight, that's the word I'm looking for. At first sight, am I nuts? Am I a criminal? Do I have tendencies? Answer the question.
I wish it was that easy, because then we wouldn't have to study so much to become, for instance, psychologists or criminologists. It's not that easy. But if you want me to be honest with you, any person can be a criminal. Anybody can commit a crime. So it's not about something that we have inside that makes us criminals or not criminals. There is not a gene for criminality. So anybody can commit a crime when there is an opportunity to do it and we are in need of something. So the criminal behavior depends on that, on motivations, but also on opportunities. So anybody can become a criminal.
So people, you've heard this first. So if one day I absolutely lose it and accidentally kill one of my students, okay? You heard it first. Virginia said, I was like everybody. I'm normal. So it was just a little accident. You know, I just killed them with the use of the present perfect or phrasal verbs wrapped up in a book, and I hit them until they died. Okay. In your group, and again, we come back to the same thing. So I suppose you're going to give the same answer, but I want you to give a different answer. As they say, mojarse, don't sit on the fence, my friend. Do not sit on the fence. When you look at your group, your first years, and you walk into that room and you're kind of giving a lecture and you're talking to people, do you look and you think, Miguel, or Lucia, they don't look right. You know, the eyes are too close together. You know, there's a little squint there. Tell me the truth. No sitting on the fence now. Have there been times when you've seen students in your classes and you thought, ooh, potential?
I have to say, if I'm honest, I have to say the opposite. Because this degree is so popular, the students we have one of the highest grades from the PAU, not the exam to access the university. So actually we have very, very high-skilled students. They are very focused, taking notes all the time. So sometimes we have to say, hey, go to the streets and
do something. And just, enjoy and do life. Something.
Because you will become a criminologist. I'm not here saying that people have to commit crimes, but it's very important.
People have to commit. This will have to. People have to commit crimes.
But I think, as any other social science, if you want to understand society, you need to observe society. So you have to spend time on the streets, observing, see how life is going. So if you don't open your mind, you don't open your eyes, you don't observe, then you are going to be very naive when it comes to work with somebody in a criminal setting, in terms of how will you deal with people in prison if you don't even have knowledge of what is it to live in a poor neighborhood,
or right,
how other types of people live their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are very used to and we are lucky here in Spain. We have access to education with an accessible price. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's free, but it's in comparison to other countries, it's very cheap. And that means that our students are not only the children of rich people. So right. We have a mix of students, and that's great. And that's what it has to be when it comes to higher education. But we have to say it, our students are not representative of the whole population.
So we brought to a close that part of the conversation. And then what I wanted to ask was, how is it for her using English in her collaborations abroad for leisure and also on the professional aspect? Mainly in the States, I think you've done a lot of work. What is it like working?
It's completely different. How we work in Spain is very different to how research is done in other countries. And many times, I have to say, we do a lot in Spain with how little resources we have. Mm-hmm. And we are, I think, we are particularly good at multitasking. Here in Spain, it's not about being specialized in something and only do that in which you are specialized. You have to be good at doing paperwork. You have to be good at teaching. You have to be good at researching. You also have to be good at learning lots of languages, because only with Spanish you cannot collaborate with others. Whereas you travel to universities, for instance, in the States, and you see, well, first of all, the money they have, no, in the universities, but and that is linked to what I said before. Universities in the States are not as accessible as our universities here. And that's when it comes to research, of course, if you have money, if you have resources, if you have partners, if you have research assistants, research is done
but for you,
in a different way.
But for you, what's kind of maybe the most significant or the most notable difference in terms of maybe doing the actual research? Because obviously you said there's the money aspects and the focus, where maybe people have research assistants who do many other things. But in terms of one particular thing that you think you like or you dislike?
I guess because of this money availability. I never said
don't worry,
word,
I have many
right.
words I can't say, you know. So, yeah, availability.
Yeah. I think so projects are done, goals are getting achieved, and it's everything, you work for a purpose and then you get it, and it's not so erratic. So I think it's everything is more focused, and yeah. It's more okay. We and also the amount of meetings.
Yeah.
They have many meetings. I had to tell one American professor who came here for a research day that we do our meetings mainly during meals. So our lunch is mm-hmm. where we, even if it's not a formal meeting, is when you get many of the ideas that you develop.
Before we continue, she actually stressed the importance of learning a language, not necessarily English, but whatever language, French, Italian, etc. This led me on to asking her about her language skills. This is her response. Tell me, I think it's three or four languages you speak. Tell the world, tell the podcasting world, the 25 listeners that we may have, and the one from one of your courses at university. How many languages do you speak?
If we count Valencia, well, I speak Spanish. I'm a native speaker in Spanish. I also speak Valencian. I teach in a public university, which means we have to teach both in Spanish and in Valencia. And then I speak English. Well, obviously, right now I'm doing it, so you can check. And I speak Italian and French.
You see? So many languages. How did you get into this whole language thing? Because this is a lot of languages. I mean, I've been here like 1,000 years, and I just I mean, Valenciano, I mean, I only know three or four words just because of students I've had, but I don't speak Valenciano. And even Spanish, I have to admit, some days I have my good days and I have my bad days, you know. So for all the years I've been here, how did you learn so many languages? What's the key, my friend?
So it was not my choice. It was my parents' choice and I guess life in general. So my mom used to be an English teacher.
Ah, right.
Which means, yeah, since the beginning I had this. But actually, here, if my mom is a bit upset because her goal with me was to me to speak euskera because actually I'm from the Basque Country. So I speak Valenciano, but I don't speak euskera. And my mom was very frustrated about that.
Basque is like really difficult. Come on.
Yeah, that's very, very difficult. So she used to speak to me in euskera, but obviously I didn't listen. I didn't listen to her because I don't
You just
know.
Started to answer in English and say, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then since in life, we moved to Italy when I was a little kid. And my parents had a great idea of saying, okay, so since this little girl will have to learn a new language, why not learn two languages at the same time? So I was enrolled in the French school at that time. So I did the primary school in French, in Italian, and I had also English as a subject. And, so that's why. That's the secret.
But is there any techniques that you could suggest or offer to people in terms of how to actually develop the language? Okay. We assume that they've learned something. Okay, so actually improve on their language skills rather than learning from scratch, but improve on it.
So for me, my relation to learning languages is I love this particular characteristic now of myself, and I always try to keep the level of the languages. I try not to forget any of them because it's hard not to maintain every single of them. And what I always do. I always buy books in the other languages. I know.
Right.
So I force myself to read books in Italian, in French, in English. For me, English it was the last language that I learned. So it was the hardest for me to get because I was not that immersed as in the others.
Yeah.
And I forced myself to read books in English. At the beginning, I started to read the book and I didn't understand anything. It took me a while. And of course, I would have enjoyed more to read a book in other language, but I had to force myself to do it. And for instance, I remember I had all day the radio in English. These radio stations are all day.
Yeah, yeah, just on the regular radio stations who are just playing music and also speaking in English. Yeah.
Yes. So all day that the radio there, I was doing house chores and. The radio. I'm a very shy person, but when it comes to languages, I had to lose this
shyness.
Yeah. I had to lose it, and that connects to traveling, right? So I travel a lot, and I used to go by myself and go to hostels, and I started speaking with anybody so what is the language that we have in common? And then on the same day, I was speaking English, French, Italian. I was the official translator the group. And I had to meet people which otherwise I wouldn't do it. In Spanish, I would never go to somebody I don't know and say, hi, how are you doing? That's something I would never do. But because it comes to languages, it's the only way you can practice.
Right.
So you have to do that.
And talking about the traveling, you said you used to travel, or you travel a lot, and you used to travel a lot alone. What was the sensation like traveling alone, or as a woman traveling alone as well?
It was scary at the beginning because of this part, of being a woman, you're traveling alone. Many people would tell me, but how did you dare? Isn't it dangerous? But I started doing it because I thought, okay, otherwise I'm not going to go anywhere because if you have to stick to the agendas
right.
of everybody, it's impossible to travel. And then I said, okay, let's do it. And what I did was instead of being by myself in an Airbnb or in a hotel, I always try to go to hostels where they were particularly known by doing activities.
Right.
So when I searched on the internet, I said, okay, these hostels every day has social activities with other people.
Yeah.
Because if I'm in a place I don't know the place, I wouldn't dare to go alone at night. Well, for dinner, yes, but after dinner, no. So that's why I started saying, okay, if I go to a hostel that they organize a pub crawl, I can go with the guys at the hostel with other girls, with other men, and then I can socialize, and it's the only way I will go out for a beer at night. So that was how I do that.
You kind of broke that kind of shyness, you say. Would you still class yourself as a person who is a little bit introvert, a little bit shy? Did you say introvert, or am I putting words into your mouth?
Yeah, it's true. Yes, I'm introvert, yeah.
Okay. Is it about your subject matter which takes away that introvertness, or is it something, techniques you just have learned over the years because you've done it quite a few times? How do you manage that?
Well, I think, of course, I'm a psychologist, and you know how we think about all this kind of stuff.
Do you take something a little bit stronger to help you?
No. I think actually...
Do you still get very, very nervous about doing these kind of public talks, in a sense?
I remember the first talk I had to do in English was in Germany. I was terrified. I had to write everything. I had to read. And right now, I just speak in English as it was a normal thing, and I don't think about it, and I'm not terrified about it because I feel confident. At the beginning, and I think this is also very connected to the Spanish culture and how we learn languages and how we have been seen speaking in another language, we are very focused on, okay, unless I speak perfectly, unless I have the perfect accent, people will laugh of how I speak English. And this is something from school we all have, I remember.
That's one of these things which, you know, I try very, very hard to get people to kind of try to dispel that whole idea. When we have something specific to do, we can practice and work at performing as best as we can. When it's the day-to-day things, we just need to communicate. We just need to talk, and we don't need to be 100% perfect. And everybody has a little bit of a fault in this. English teachers, whether they're native or non-native English teachers, I don't really mind if you get the mistakes wrong, because you're not doing an exam. You're going to a shop to buy a shirt, and you want it to be in blue and red and this size. It may take you 15 minutes, but if you come out with the shirt, fantastic. If you come out with an elephant, there's a small problem. What are you doing now? Because like I said, we haven't spoken for nearly, I don't know, well over 10,000 years. I do things in big numbers. You may notice if you listen to some of the podcasts. I kind of like start from the Greeks and then work upwards, basically. So what have you been doing? What kind of stuff have you been up to? Not work.
Activities, well, I keep traveling, I keep practicing my languages, and mostly I travel to the States, to the United States, because of work reasons and personal reasons. Yeah.
And what's the fun things? When you go to the States, are there things that you look at and you think, it can only be here? You just kind of look and you think, it can only be here.
The States is just a different world. It's just, you have to be there, you have to live there to understand things that are going on. Because if you see how things work there from the European mind, you will never get it. You will never understand. But then you spend time there and you say, oh, okay, I see. That's why. Now it makes sense to me. Although it will never make sense because it's always crazy shit that is going on there. I just thank you for the opportunity, and again, just encourage everybody to keep doing it, to persist on learning English, and of course, if anybody is interested
English,
in technology,
any languages, you know, I think I just learning something, enjoy what you're learning, and find a method that helps you. You know, that's the key thing. The kind of standard rote method sometimes doesn't fit everybody. So try and find the thing that helps you. And this is from a woman who speaks 4 other languages. So she should know. Ladies and gentlemen, all the podcasting world, podcasting universe, this was a nice little chat with Virginia. I'd really like to thank Virginia. We ran a little bit longer than I normally like to do, but I thought it was interesting. I think she was a little bit nervous, so next time she comes on, hopefully she's a bit more relaxed and we can get some nice anecdotes about the USA. That was not an FBI agent. That was not a Spanish policewoman, but it was a woman who speaks four languages and is a forensic psychologist. That was Virginia. My name is Denzel Mills. This was Silly Conversations. Until next time, see ya.
The voices and the names have been changed in this podcast to protect the wicked. For any grammar, information, or correction, please ask someone else, not me.